I'm saying most people don't have anything interesting to say.
Shots fired.
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 367 for the week of August 9th, 2021. I am Deep Metaphoric Asteroid Impact David T. Cole, and I'm here with Human Weighted Blanket Sarah D. Bunting.
The Dodgers are on.
Unhelpful Medical Receptionist Tara Ariano.
Have you tried focusing on your breathing?
And woke fifth grader Camille Washington.
Class is in session.
And also my dogs who are barking.
Quiet.
Quiet, you. We're going to talk about Mr. Corbin.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us, she's the co-host of the Unfriendly Black Hotties podcast and a past guest of this show. It's Camille Washington. Camille!
Hello.
Welcome back.
Hi. Yay! I'm so happy to be back.
We're thrilled to have you to talk about Mr. Corman, in which the titular Josh Mr. Corman, paid by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, formerly had a music career of some kind, which possibly is part of the reason he is sober now. Currently, he's teaching fifth grade at a public school in Los Angeles, but he seems not to be at peace with his career change or in general, and a significant portion of the first two episodes revolve around the generalized anxiety he is experiencing and can no longer ignore. Two episodes have dropped on Apple TV+. We got six screeners. There will be 10 episodes this season, I read. So we may mention non-spoily stuff from later episodes. Let us do the Chen check-in. Camille, should our listeners watch Mr. Corman?
Yes, they definitely should watch Mr. Corman.
Okay, Sarah.
I'm not a definitely on this, but I'm going to say no.
Dave.
I would say if the phrase Atlanta but with NPR energy intrigues you, have at it.
Yep.
Yeah, this was not for me either. I'm going to say no. So let's get into this. I love it when we have a spread of opinions. The positive reviews of the show, there were not many, agreed on one point, which is that it's a slow burn, but it's worth giving it a chance to unfold. Camille, does this line still work on you at this late stage of content plenitude, or did it ever?
Well, I'll say this about Mr. Corman. The first episode did not blow me away. In fact, I quite hated it based on the first episode. Mm-hmm. And I only watched two episodes. So I watched the second episode and I had a complete reversal.
Okay.
So I'd be curious about, you know, what y'all thought about later episodes if you watched them. Mm-hmm. I think that it is telling a story that is not necessarily needed. That is my primary critique of mm-hmm. Mr. Corman. Mm-hmm. I think most women who have dated men, most people who have dated men have encountered this type, and it is an exhausting type. Mm-hmm. I will say that. And so that was what was tiring about the first episode of the show. But the second episode of the show, I think, had a narrower kind of thematic purpose that was really engaging to me. And so based on the strength of that second episode, I am inclined to keep watching it.
Okay. Sarah, you were more on the fence. What were your thoughts?
I was on the fence. I would like to say that there are a couple of moments in the first episode. There were a couple of moments that I was like, starting with, as you noted on Twitter, Tara, like, get your goddamn Samba classics off the couch. Get them off the couch.
Not just off the couch, on the throw pillow. People nap on that.
Why? Like, if that's symbolic of his malaise, find another way.
Sure.
You tried all the other ways.
And it's worth noting that he has roommates. This is not just his house where he can do what he wants.
Yeah. Right. But his roommate and his friends provided the most engaging moments of the first episode for me. Arturo Castro, as his roommate Victor, is immediately delightful. Mm-hmm. And agreed. I also enjoyed when he like basically has a fit in the first episode and is like, I'm going out, you know, in the world. And then they're all just sitting there like getting baked, playing video games. And then the one dude slowly lifts his beer bottle to his lips. It just, this famously visual medium of podcasting can't do it justice. But there are moments in it, like there are moments right in the beginning of the first episode where Joseph Gordon-Levitt is like, he gives you a novella with his face in the shower of like hope, shame, determination. Like there are good performances here, but then the second episode is like, as someone who has panic disorder and has done exactly this battle with the insurance establishment, it's like, I do not want in my entertainment. And also I'm not sure, like Camille said, that this is a story that is needed. I appreciate that he's trying to do some different things with the storytelling. And I don't mind some of the like magical realism with the comet and stuff like that. And okay, there's apparently going to be some musical sequences. I've made my peace with the fact that the culture is doing that now. But there are just moments in it that are like cringe for the sake of cringe, that it's like, this is how humans who don't know each other are horrible to each other. Like I don't, at this particular juncture in 2021, want that, more of that, besides like the nonfiction background of our lives. So this is like, I don't think it's bad, and I completely believe reviews that are like, just hang on, and then it pays off, but I'm not going to stick with it. And I think if you don't have the patience for this, malaise, that you shouldn't either. But it does do some things well, and Arturo Castro should be in everything because he's cute and fun, and I liked him.
Well, I want to just thread through some of the things that both of you said, Camille, you know, that this isn't a story that needs to be told, Sarah, that Arturo Castro is great. One of the other things that both that the positive reviews highlighted was the fourth episode, which is called Mr. Morales, and it just is all from his point of view. And we learn they already established that he works for UPS. He's a driver. And we learn he's divorced and he has a daughter who's a teen and their relationship is not great. So this episode revolves around her coming back to his place that he shares with Mr. Corman for a visit and what happens like just between the two of them. And it's so much better. And in Dan Feinberg's review at The Hollywood Reporter, he was like, this is the problem when you switch perspectives in a show, which happens, you know, more and more. That's another trope of TV these days, which is when you change perspectives, then you might end up being like, why wasn't this the show instead of this other show? Because he's so much more engaging. So, you know, I'm not going to go so far and say stick watching until episode four, but I was glad that I did because it was definitely...
I might tag back in for that because I just found something compelling about him that as good as JGL almost always is, it just was like, I felt like maybe he is wasted on this particular thing, but that's just where I'm at right now. I think this really could go either way for a lot of people. So the Chen check-in is kind of tough for me to do this time, but...
Yeah. Well, Camille, Sarah touched on this, the sort of multimedia aspects of it. How did those work for you?
So I felt simultaneously like they were a bit precious at times. But I don't ever want to discourage... you know, a TV show that is trying something different and interesting. Right. And so I thought that episode two was a little bit more successful than the first episode in doing that. Something that really got me was that anxiety gong that kept like ringing throughout the episode. And it was like causing me anxiety. My dogs were getting anxiety about it. And it was, it helped really contribute to a cohesive mood and feeling in that episode. But to your earlier point about like, you know, do we need to look at the way that people are mean and awful to each other in dating in 2021? It's like that dating sequence in episode one, I barely got through it. I mean, that
that was brutal.
Yeah, it was really brutal. And like, for what purpose? I felt like his character was all, like, we already have an understanding of who this guy is. Did we really need to have this irredeemable interaction? Yeah. Like no one came out of that looking good. And I didn't really understand the purpose.
When I used to write essays in university, you know, they'd usually be like history essays. So I'd have this thesis, and then I would gather all my points for that thesis and sort of do an outline and then write a conclusion and then go back and sort of like, because the thesis would sort of morph a little bit as I collected all the little facts I thought I would get, I would go back to the start and sort of rearrange things, cut, change, find new, footnotables and stuff like that. And I feel like this show is sort of doing that, but they haven't gone back and sort of smoothed out all the disparate points they made and arranged them in a satisfactory manner. I feel like because he is like the creator and the star and the producer and he does craft services, like maybe too many things for one person on such a people know these feelings, right? Because these are sort of like universal things. And so many more people are going through this sort of stuff now. And I feel like the devices in which he tries to project these feelings of anxiety, depression, malaise needed to sort of like go back and do that second draft and sort of pick and choose better and flow better. Because while I appreciate sort of these flights of fancy parts, the comet and all these sort of like metaphorical in your face flourishes, it was like too much. It was like, what are you doing? Are you doing quirky fey malaise story? Like it battled constantly, not in a sort of way that put me off kilter and made me experience anxiety, but more that it pulled me out of it. And I don't know how much of this he has experienced in his personal life, but I felt like a lot of that was substituting for genuine, heartfelt sort of emotional moments. Like there is a distance to this whole series that is hard to close.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Some of those were COVID workarounds, apparently, I read in one of the reviews as well, which that was interesting to me. They also shot a bunch of it in New Zealand in order to finish it. Yeah, New Zealand Wellington for LA. We see it all the time. in terms of the mental illness projections, I was reminded Von Dunn, which we talked about when it came out a couple of years ago on Amazon, which I think did a similar sort of thing in trying to visually represent aspects of mental illness. But I think that one was more successful. And that was more what the whole show was about, as opposed to just here is a guy in LA who's a teacher and has this sort of backstory that's slowly filled in. But yeah, he did everything. Like he really, this is his baby in so many ways. So it's sort of like, it feels weird criticizing it because it's so much him, I guess. But, you know, the other thing is that he's still trying to be the sad cutie from 500 Days of Summer. And he's like, he's 40. Dude, yeah. you're 40 years old.
And there is an aspect of like not to bring Lena Dunham into anything, honestly. But it's one of my issues with Girls was like, do you really have like a felt experience of this particular kind of searching? Because I feel like you don't. And for whatever reason, like this is not a value judgment. I'm just saying I'm not sure. Like this seems like you're reporting on stuff people told you about being a 20-something in Williamsburg and having to work at a coffee shop. Like,
yeah,
I don't know. So some of this coming from him, like he's been famous for 30 of his 40 years or something like that. Like some of it felt a little, like Dave said, distanced and theoretical, maybe. I mean, not insincere or cynical, just like not quite plugged into the heart of it. So yeah, I mean, on top of it's being a bit depressing is kind of putting me off, but I am going to watch episode 4 because Castro's great.
All right. One last thing. Deborah Winger, though. She plays his mom.
Yes.
Camille, Deborah Winger, go off.
Yeah.
Just phenomenal. All of their conversations. I don't have that kind of relationship with my mother, which I guess I should be grateful for. But it really, like, I don't know. It contributes to this picture of this guy, like his life. It seems like either she was a single mom or like, I don't know where dad is somehow absent. We're getting that in pieces, right? It's just fun to watch even as you cringe at some of the exchanges.
And there's some Iris McKay energy for sure, which I am here for. So, yeah.
I hope this is like the first step of her on her way to getting her own Showtime like dramedy showcase show.
The Deborah Sanz, like I'm here for that.
This should be her Laura Linney or, you know, Mary Louise Parker moment. And she has a bigger showcase in the third episode where they go to, he has a sister who's played by Shannon Woodward, and they go to his niece's birthday party. And so we also get to see her boyfriend, who's played by her real husband, Arliss Howard, of like a billion years. So
that was also fun.
Nice.
So yeah, there's stuff to enjoy, but and I even as I watched three and four, I was like, okay, I see where they're going, but I still for that reason, like there's so much to watch, I can't. But maybe you can.
All right, I have a thought on that, and okay. I'll frame it in a I am not a crackpot.
Okay. Dear Mr. President, there are too many states nowadays. Please eliminate three. I am not a crackpot.
While the notion of stick with it until X, whether X is episode 3 or season 4 or whatever, it's become something we're hearing more and more of. For whatever reason, there is just more out there. The way that people make stuff for streaming is different. Who knows exactly what the reasons are? But I feel like the critical community needs to like have a system as part of like, you know how we have stars and we know what stars mean. We need to have like clocks, like out-of-time clocks. How much patience do you have to have with this show?
Right.
And then if you don't have patience, what is the point where the show actually becomes better? Because frankly, a lot of this, it gets better stuff I read from the critics. Reads like Stockholm Syndrome sometimes. Like it really is, I have to find something good to say about it and find an avenue into not being like David T. Cole where he just goes... And because, you know, I'm a busy person, I'd like to live my life, I don't want to invest 7 hours into something, which everybody says, it gets better, but in the end, Mr. Corman is just okay. That doesn't sound like a good bargain to me.
Yeah.
So there needs to be some sort of ROI, time versus commitment versus, you know, return on investment, how good the show gets better, when it does get better, and maybe a little stopwatches or something, or little brains or something. But I feel like that would that would help a lot.
Yeah, the show shot clock.
Yes, yeah. Basically, right. Yeah. I am not a crackpot. It is time to go around the dial. As always, we will start with Tara.
Hello.
Hi.
First up, my highbrow show, First Wives Club. This was not on my radar when it first premiered in 2019, but earlier this year, it popped up on the Showtime app. It was a BT show originally. Everyone knows the premise of the First Wives Club, the movie, and this is a loose adaptation, which was created by Tracy Oliver, who also wrote Girls Trip. Once again, as in the movie, we have three women having marital problems. Not all of them are that they've gotten too old and their husbands want to dump them for much younger women. So first we have Hazel, played by Jill Scott. She's an R&B artist. Her husband, Derek Malik Yoba, is also her manager. But when he announces that his 20-something protege is releasing her debut album on the same day as Hazel's next album, Hazel dumps him and very acrimonious divorce proceedings begin. Then we have Bree, played by Michelle Buteau, recently mentioned on this podcast as the host of The Circle. She is an orthopedic surgeon separated from her public school teacher husband because he cheated on her. And finally, Ari, played by Ryan Michelle Bath or Bathe or Bathey, B-A-T-H-E, anyway. She was a successful lawyer, but she left her career to help her husband run for state office and now feels both unfulfilled and like he's taking her for granted. And it's very Black Sex in the City. Some of the dialogue and situations are kind of corny, but it looks incredible. And I also have to note, two of the leads are plus-size women. Their wardrobe is so high-end and so sexy, like gorgeous to look at. So I devoured the first season over the course of a couple of days, which is why it pains me to say the second season, which is on BET Plus, was not hitting for me. I think I watched four. Notable guest stars include Essence Atkins, who plays Maxine. She's the CEO of an Ashley Madison type of website whose husband has her served with divorce papers when she's in the middle of speaking at a public event. Deborah Cox is a former Hazel collaborator who was shed as Hazel's career took off, and she's still bitter about it. And Gary Dorden from CSI, looking exactly the same, by the way. He plays a hospital higher-up who's courting Bree to be the new chief of surgery. But the production moved from New York to Georgia in the hiatus, and you can tell. In the story, Ari has moved to Los Angeles for work. She hasn't been in a scene with any other actor in any of the episodes I watched. Like, it's always she's on the phone or she's coming home to a different apartment.
Chrissy Snow.
Yeah. No, we see her, but she's just not with anyone else.
Oh, okay.
So there is a new character in Fake New York, Jayla, played by Michelle Michener, who is clearly doing all the things Ari was supposed to be doing this season if she could be on set. She works at a law firm. She goes for brunch and out to parties with the other ladies. The right around is Ari was Jayla's mentor, and she's new to New York, and Ari asked her friends to, like, include her. But since Jayla is supposed to be millennial and the leads are Gen X, they can't even say they all used to hang out in college or whatever. So when she knows all about the other two women's lives in lines that were clearly originally written for Ari, it's weird. And it looks like Bath is doing another show with Marina Bakarin. So I guess because of COVID, the scheduling didn't work out for her to do both. And they just sent one crew to wherever she was. But it obviously had to be rewritten in haste. And it shows. And also, Bree had sex with a bartender when she and her husband were separated in the season one. And now her husband just hired him to look after the house and the kids. Oh, no. This is such a sitcom thing to do, which it is a sitcom, but like cheap. So I went through and counted. Other than the creator, there are two credited writers on season two who also worked on the first season, and one of the new writers worked on Mystery Girls, Sarah, the Tori Spelling Jenny Garth sitcom on ABC Family. So, yeesh.
Nope.
Yeah. So the first season filmed all the way back in 2018. People have had to take new jobs. It's complicated. I get it. But these actors in this premise deserve better. It is a bummer. But you should still watch the very good first season on Showtime. And if you're shooting something in Atlanta, someone out there should take my long-ago suggestion and do a remake of Designing Women about four black women, and at least one of them should be Jasmine Guy, or do I have to do everything? I won't do that. Next, my lowbrow pick, and it's real lowbrow, F-Boy Island. This is
the lowest of brows.
New reality dating competition show on HBO Max, hosted by Nikki Glaser of Comedy Central Roasts fame. It's The Bachelor, except there are three bachelorettes, and there are 24 hot men. As on Bachelorette, some of the men are there looking for love. Some just want to fuck and or be on TV. But the difference is 12 of the dudes are self-described nice guys, debatable, and 12 proudly declare themselves F-boys, and the women don't know which are which. So there are various gimmicks for how they decide which dudes get one-on-one dates with the ladies. And at the end of the episode, the women cut some of the guys. And only then do they find out which kind of guy each of them was, or at least that was the case for the first few episodes. Later in the season, they all have to reveal their fuck status. I don't know. Whatever. There's a great moment in the first dismissals ceremony where one of the guys who gets cut announces that he wrote a poem, and the woman is like, oh, God, which, correct. But the kiss-off line is not bad. Clip one.
Andrew? Garrett P., nice guy, nice try. Peter, F-boy, F-by.
Now, I think it should be F-boy, F-off, but no one asked me. So at the end of the pilot, one F-boy gets driven to a place called Limbro. And in later episodes, we see it's like a fenced-in corral on the beach, which the nice guys can see from the balcony at Nice Guy Grotto, which is where they get driven to. We're supposed to think the F-boys are, like, living in survivor circumstances. Like, I doubt it. But there's an element whereby someone, unclear who or how, could win up to $100,000. It's not explained in the first three episodes. Honestly, who cares? A word about that title. I get that calling it F-Boy Island on, like, posters and when you search for it in HBO Max is something you have to do. But once you're actually in the episode, we're still not allowed to all be adults and say fuck boy. Like, they say fuck. They say motherfucker.
You have to grow the brand.
I guess. Joe.
They say moist. Just
Joe was going to be on the podcast next week, Joe Reed. He made this point in his review on Primetimer, which we'll link in the show notes. But it's a bit rich to act like we're not using the real term because this is a family show or something. When we get lines like this, clip two.
And ultimately, you will get to answer the questions that women have been asking themselves for decades. Do good guys really deserve to always finish last? And do F-boys always have to finish on our face?
I mean...
Not sure I've been asking that for decades.
Well,
I do have questions now.
Yeah. So I like the show acknowledges women might knowingly choose a fuckboy for the reasons that fuckboys are fuckboys, and which mm-hmm. is their moves work. Even if you know they're not relationship material, they can be sexy and fun, and a guy who's too earnest, especially in a context like this poem guy, might turn you off. But this is also a show full of the dumbest people you have literally ever seen, which makes it kind of impossible to root for any of the women because they are all so, 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 so stupid. Dave, you can play clip 3 and clip 4 back to back.
I want to know more about you, though. How do you view life?
I'm bratty.
Okay. How does that show up in relationships?
I'd like to see people who balance me.
Really? Huh.
If someone matches my energy all the time, we're going to get arrested. I have my dramatic moments.
So you got a little toxicity?
I would not say toxic. Okay. I think that's a very harsh word. Bitch, do not call me toxic. Here's a tip to all the men. Do not call a woman toxic or crazy. I'm not crazy.
Well, we're all good guys here, so.
Y'all are super nice. Yeah. That's really suspicious.
So me after the first episode, fine, I guess I could talk about it on the podcast. Me Friday night watching episodes 4 to 6 starting at 1 a.m. If this is your flavor of trash, it is not usually mine. It's very well made and well cast. It has the look of Are You the One? Is that the MTV show? It's like mm-hmm. it's very MTV in its attitude.
Okay.
I recommend it.
Intriguing.
It's bad, but I enjoyed it.
Uh-huh.
For my plug, I interviewed Paul Scheer about the end of season 3 of Black Monday, the Showtime sitcom. It is super spoily about a big plot reveal in that episode. So if you watch Black Monday but you haven't watched the finale yet, don't read the interview until after you've rectified that.
Camille, what do you have for us?
So I have a little bit more trash for us. So I recently discovered a new Real Housewives franchise, Real Housewives of Potomac. Now, this is not a new franchise. It's airing its 6th season currently. But I got drawn in and started watching season 5 after a little bit of a Twitter nonsense in which it seems like Nicki Minaj may be hosting the season 6 reunion of the Real Housewives of Potomac. And Wow. I heard that and I said, I simply must know everything about these women so that I am adequately studied up for when mm-hmm. the reunion comes in December. So I started watching season 5 and it seemed like a good time to enter the show because season 5 is very explosive and features a physical altercation between two housewives, mm-hmm. which, of course, we do not glorify violence, as Bravo says many times. We don't condone violence. And then proceeds to show a clip of the fight at every possible opportunity for something like 13 episodes of season 5. Season 5 also introduces a new housewife, Wendy Osifo, who they call Dr. Wendy. Now, Dr. Wendy has 4 degrees. She has a bachelor's, 2 master's degrees, and a PhD, and is, in fact, a faculty member at the Johns Hopkins University.
Wow.
Oh, dear.
As you can imagine, this gets spoken about quite often, and more than once, she says, it's Dr. Wendy to you, and that is simply incredible energy. Oh.
Wow.
Yeah, there's also, you know, affairs all over the place. I think at one point, 3 husbands out of whatever 6 or 7 are involved allegedly in some sort of affair. And these women, I mean, all of the Real Housewives women across franchises are gossipy. Right? We know this.
Sure.
But ordinarily, there is some modicum of decorum, some effort to pretend as though they are not as gossipy as they in fact are. And something that's actually really refreshing about the Potomac Housewives is that they have no qualms about calling each other 3-way on speakerphone and just really obviously being messy and owning their mess, which it's just fascinating to watch. There's a lot of really amazing one-liners. These women are funny. All of them are funny. They are all able to get in good jabs. There's also the traditional intergenerational element where there is an older housewife who in this season is really trying to reignite her relationship with her partner, Ray. Her name is Karen, also known as La Dame. She has a perfume, she has a wig line, and she is just out here doing it for the 55 plus crowd. And there's a lot of talk about whether or not La Dame is pussy popping or not, and whether or not she's really having a good time with her husband in the boudoir. And it's just a common topic of conversation. They have an amazing girls' trip to Madeira, Portugal, which for some reason ends with like a dominatrix sex toy party.
Sure.
Like, sure.
When in Madeira.
I was going to say Portugal stuff.
Yeah. And it has been an incredible delight, a real joy to kill brain cells watching this program. And, you know, now I'm ready to watch the current season, which I think is maybe 4 or 5 episodes in at this point. Mm-hmm. And fingers crossed for that Nicki Minaj reunion, which would be huge. It would be the first and only time I think that Andy Cohen has not hosted a reunion if it comes to pass. So
incredible.
We'll see.
I mean, I noticed with the Jersey franchise that the messiness was much more like in the front window once the pandemic hit, because I feel like they were just like, we don't know how much longer we're even going to be allowed to film. So let's just make the machinations very direct. And there's almost none of that filler from previous seasons. Like it's all planning a party, being at the party, pulling each other's extensions at the party, gossiping yes. about the party, and then occasionally footage of a table flip that Teresa did like 15 years ago. So like the fact that they kind of boiled it down, it's like sort of eating Tang straight from the jar, that it's like, oh, that's too much. But you know what? We don't need the water. Just the Tang.
What would you like to plug, Camille?
I would love to plug my podcast, The Unfriendly Black Hotties. Currently on hiatus, but I encourage you to take a look at the back catalog. The Unfriendly Black Hotties is a podcast that discusses the intersection between race, gender, and sexuality in politics and pop culture. It's a fabulous listen. I co-host it with Christina Tucker, who is a former guest of this show.
Indeed.
And we have a great old time. So check us out, theblackhotties.com.
Sarah D. Bundick.
Hello, it's time for a Grandpa Buncey CNBC twofer. It is premiere week on CNBC as you're listening to this. Super Heists premiered Monday. That's exactly what it sounds like. I think basically someone at CNBC was like, what if American Greed, but only heists? So they started with the Nixon bank job, which was the subject of a docudrama Finding Steve McQueen, starring William Fichtner and his skin-tight dungarees. Mm-hmm. Approve that message always. And then Tuesday of this week, The Prophet returned for season 8, which is crazy to me. And then Money Court, which is like People's Court meets Shark Tank, starring Mr. Wonderful from Shark Tank, with a dash of the Chrissy Teigen Judge Show. That is, as you're listening to this, tonight. So I theorized on my True Crime Review newsletter, Best Evidence, that CNBC is maybe trying to make a true crime play, and right. that at the, you know, NBC executive suites, like pitches come in and there's just like an automated pneumatic filing system that sends prestige crime stuff like Dirty John to Bravo or USA. And then the real trashy, like Wives with Knives, Sisters Who Kill, whatever, goes to Oxygen. And then stuff that has anything to do with money, which actually is kind of most of it, but anyway, goes to CNBC. And then, of course, the flagship network has Dateline. Yes. Keith Morrison will always work. Super Heists and Money Court are both fine. I've seen them both. If you like hotel TV, which we talk about pretty frequently on this podcast, like you're not going to DVR it or necessarily even seek it out. But between the ceremony and the reception, when you're just like getting changed, putting on a fresh coat of lipstick, or like waiting around in the hotel, this is a perfect thing to watch for an hour, 2 hours. Tara and Dave and I have become becalmed by Shark Tank many times. Like it starts out that we're like, let's just make fun of this until a Law & Order rerun comes on. And then like darkness
40% falls. Yeah.
Does suck you Don't in. Do it.
I know. Is it? Don't we already have toilet paper for this? Yeah. So I can't like giving it a grade, either show a grade is not necessarily appropriate, but I do appreciate that CNBC, whether it's directly acknowledging this or not, understands that the Venn of like high finance, which it does during the day, and people being creeps, which it does at night, is like practically a circle. And it's right. Just like, how can we leverage this to make ourselves more money? And that's what they're doing. Like, I sort of admire that that's a little bit of a scam. Super Heists could use a Stacey Keachy narrator like American Greed has, but you know, actually I was going to say there's only one Keach, but that's not true. I believe he has a couple of brothers, and you know, maybe should get one of them.
Maybe CNBC should also consider cornering the market on adding super to things other people do and just see how that plays out. Like, what is the dividing line between a heist and a super heist? Is it the amount
dollar
of money
amount?
They take, amount of people that
I'm
die?
I'm not sure. I'm interested to see, because we only got, you know, they give you one screener. They're pretty tight with the screeners on that network, except sometimes the profit, but the profit is more like more positive and about, you know, a happy outcome. And these are just like, look at this asshole. Like, okay, yes.
What about a show called Super Profit?
Mm. Super Profit.
Super Ooh. Murders. Like, mm-hmm. I'm just saying CNBC can just like pretend they're doing better than everybody else
right.
by adding super to, like, we had Mario Brothers and now we have Super Mario Brothers. Which one do you rather play?
Super
I guess
small
Super
fortune.
Mario Brothers.
Yes.
Super small. Super Shark Tank.
Yes. Yeah.
To catch a super predator.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
super wives with super knives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I think.
A wood watch.
I got to edit this out. This is gold. We got to make this happen on our own.
For my future reviews of Super Sisters Who Super Kill and many, many other properties, I write a true crime newsletter every weekday with my co-author Eve Beatty. That is at bestevidence.fyi, and that'll be in the show notes.
Woo. I watched a couple episodes of Showtime's documentary series UFO, which is J.J. Abrams producing. Oh. You know why it is J.J. Abrams producing? You know how I figured that out? Because just in like guy in a hotel room talking head interviews, there's fucking lens flares in those.
Oh my God.
I'm I was not about to, making super this lens flare. Shit up. Like those dramatic new Star Trek blue, you know, horizontal lens flares that he loves, they're in the fucking interviews with some guy talking about declassified such and such as this. Anyways, I thought that was amusing. If you've ever watched any documentary that is about UFOs, you have watched this one. The production is slightly better, but not like premium cable. Oh my God, what are they doing better? It's just like the same Ken Burnsian tricks to like, here's a newspaper clipping from 1953 and it's sliding across the screen. A lot of that.
Ancient Abram experts say.
Exactly. Nothing new, nothing really intriguing there. So if you were hoping that UFO would sort of reinvent something or reinvigorate the genre, skip it, forget about it. Doesn't do it. It was disappointing. Let me tell you what's happening here at Extra Hot Great this Friday on Extra, Extra Hot Great, the podcast that puts extra into Extra Hot Great. We are talking about co-host couples, celebrity couples, what show should they be making? What's it called? What's it about? What's the format? All that on Extra Extra Hot Great this Friday, available to subscribers at any level, patreon.com/extrahotgreat.
Should we rename that Super Extra Hot Great?
Yes, we should. Thank you.
Or do we have to rob a bank? I'm asking, I'm putting it out there.
And just on regular, just okay, Extra Hot Great Prime, next week, our good friend Joe Reed returns to talk about the wrestling dramedy Heels.
It's not going to be regular. It's going to be wonderful. We love Joe and we liked Heels.
Super Joe.
Super Joe.
Today's extra credit topic comes to us from Courtney and Craig, who co-submitted the King of the Hill canon submission recently. It's called Who Here Vapes? And here's the topic. I'm just going to read it.
This is my favorite one of these we've had in a while.
It's so good.
This is great.
There is an ongoing bit in our household where we try to decide which TV characters are the most likely to vape obnoxiously.
Yeah.
Which of your favorite or least favorite TV characters vape. For example, Senior Chang definitely vapes 100%.
Sure.
I think we all have a bunch. I just counted. I have 12.
Wow.
So should we just each take turns and read all of them?
Yep.
Scrubs, the Todd. Mm-hmm. Bob's Burgers, Jimmy Pesto Sr., WandaVision, the fake Pietro, the one played by Evan Peters, who was actually an actor,
yep.
Spoiler.
Yep, yep.
The other two, their mom, the Molly Shannon character, she vapes. The Office, Kelly. Bridgerton, Portia Featherington, actually every Polly Walker character vapes. See also Peggy on Pennyworth and Attia of the Julii on Rome, they vape. On Friends, Paolo and Barry, mm-hmm. both Rachel love interests. Melrose Place, Joe, she vapes. Downton Abbey,
yeah.
Thomas, vapor. News Radio, Matthew, he would try to vape and fail as an affectation. He would fail to make mm-hmm. it work. CSI, Greg. We've been watching CSI. Dave knows this too. He vapes
absolutely.
For sure. And finally, this one is mostly for Dave. On Futurama, the monkey of above average intelligence who just wanted to go to business school. Vapes.
Yeah.
Camille.
Okay. I have a shorter list, but I think that they're all knockouts.
Okay.
Joan Ryan, a Veep?
Yes!
Mm-hmm. For
oh my
sure.
God, totally. Yeah, poster boy. Absolutely.
Vape of Vape.
Will Schuster of Glee.
Yeah.
Come on now.
Mm-hmm.
Come on. Pete Campbell of Mad Men.
Yeah.
Yes!
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Councilman Jam, Parks and Rec.
Oh God, yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And another Office one, Andy Bernard. That feels like a...
Yep, yeah, I can see it.
Definite.
I think so.
Yeah.
You're right. Those are all very strong.
They are very good. Sarah.
I'd like to begin by noting that while I don't think this character would vape, Emmy Rogers of the Law and Order franchises, the actor who plays her definitely vapes. And we voted next to each other in 2016. And it was one of the cooler things that had happened to me in my life until she, number one, brought the maloik by announcing to the sidewalk outside our polling site that she just voted for the first woman president of the United States. God damn it, Hendricks! And number two followed that up by whipping out the vaporatus. Like, oh my God, why? Never meet your heroes. Okay.
Should have turned right instead of left. Damn it.
God, I know. Why didn't I just decide it obviously wasn't her and keep my eyes on my shoes? But I didn't. All right, Kevin on This Is Us. He may, in fact, vape. I stopped watching seasons ago.
Yep.
AJ Soprano, if he hasn't already died some other Darwin Award kind of stupid way.
I knew that one was going to be on your list. Yeah.
His vaporatus is probably going to blow up in his face and kill him.
He super vapes.
He does super vape, yes.
Mayor Tommy Carsetti on The Wire. Mm-hmm. Dana Brody.
Yes.
All the other Brodies.
Mm-hmm.
Dawson Leary,
mm-hmm.
Jessa on Girls,
mm-hmm.
and the guy who probably invented it, but he had a little redwood case for it or some damn thing, fucking Nate Jr. on 6 Feet Under. Dave.
Yep.
Dave.
All right. Alligator Loki definitely vapes.
Mm.
Carol from Superstore absolutely vapes.
Yes.
All of Emily Dickinson, Emily Dickinson's friends vape. But death on mm-hmm. On the show does not,
mm-hmm.
for whatever reason.
Right.
Perry Mason's landlady absolutely vapes.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
All of Quibi vapes.
Yes.
All the purple Smurfs vape. Dracula from the 2020 Dracula vapes.
Yes.
But energy mogul Dracula just makes the batteries for the vapes. Okay. O'Brien from Downton Abbey vapes. And all the kids from Righteous Gemstones vape. And then all the characters from The Boys and Black Monday, they all vape as well.
Yep. Checks out.
Why, it is time for the canon. Submitting this week is Corey Not a Boy. But get this, it's the second Corey Not a Boy.
Hi, you've reached the Corey hotline. $4.95 a minute. Here are some words that rhyme with Corey. Glory. Story. Allegory. Montessori.
Hi, Extra Hot Great. Today I'm bringing you New Girl Season 2, Episode 15, Cooler, for consideration for induction into the canon. Cast your minds back to the year 2011, when New Girl premiered on Fox. Remember Adorkable? It feels like a distant memory to me, but this show was pretty zeitgeisty for a while. I would bet good money that at some point Urban Outfitters sold a douchebag jar. Also, did you know that New Girl was on the air until 2018? There's an episode where Jess is canvassing for Hillary. Did it fade from the collective consciousness, or just mine? I vaguely remember hearing something about Megan Fox being on it, but otherwise I lost track of the show after quitting it a few seasons in. Cut to April 2020. Yikes. I was looking for a light sitcom for evening viewing. New Girl fit the bill, and I found it pretty delightful. I recognize that this show was certainly not perfect. Among other issues, while the cast is racially diverse, the show is rampantly heteronormative in both its characters and values. But I believe that New Girl, at least for a while, was a very strong sitcom that deserves at least one spot in the canon. In Cooler, Schmidt, Nick, and Winston are all experiencing dry spells and plan to go out to pick up some women. Jess is asked to stay home because she's a total cockblock, or in network TV terms, a cooler. Schmidt is trying to get over Cece, Winston is rusty and nervous and strange, and Nick is convinced the women's trench coat that he's found imbues him with some strain of the Kavorka. When a bored, incapable of being alone Jess freaks out about some noises at the loft, Nick and the boys come home with some guests, including Brooklyn Decker, whose affections Nick and Schmidt are vying for. Hoping to prove that she's not a cooler, Jess proposes they all play a strip version of New Girl's favorite nonsensical U.S. history-themed drinking game, True American. The plan backfires, though, when Nick, Jess, and their crackling sexual attention find themselves locked behind the Iron Curtain, where game rules dictate they kiss. I've chosen this episode because I think it's peak New Girl. It highlights the show's strengths and features some downright iconic moments. What are those strengths? I'll posit that they are its A, weird manic energy, B, strong delineation of characters and setting, and C, chemistry. A, weird manic energy. I tend to think this show is at its strongest when it leans into its weirdness, and this episode leans pretty far in, almost approaching farce. The potentially problematic premise of the guys just going out to obtain women is diffused a bit because it becomes clear that these dudes are their own coolers. They are so fucking weird. They are lucky Jess even lets them see her topless. Which leads me to True American, which is iconic New Girl wackiness. The show went back to the True American well a few more times over the series, but since this is only the second appearance of the game, it had the advantage of feeling unexpected, yet welcome. Adding the strip element takes it to a new place and raises the narrative tension. B, characterization and place setting. When you think of New Girl, don't you just remember Los Angeles as being like the fifth roommate? Just kidding, I'm talking about the loft. The premise of the show hinges on the loft space. In the premiere, the boys need a new roommate, and Jess needs a new place to live after discovering her boyfriend cheating on her in their shared home. Never mind that these adults continue to be roommates despite evolving relationship statuses, incomes, and age. Their loft, themselves. Like his space, Nick is rumpled, lived in, and kind of a mess. And you know Schmidt accepts nothing less than hotel corners. These characters, especially Jess, Nick, and Schmidt, feel like they sprung, fully formed, Athena style from the mind of their creator. And God bless whoever came up with Schmidt's inspired mispronunciations. I do think it's noteworthy that Winston, the only character not in the pilot, feels more malleable. Here the show is beginning to explore how strange he can get. See point A. By bottling up all the familiar, known quantity main characters, plus love interest variables and long simmering tensions in the loft, The show sets itself up for a dynamic and satisfying outing, making Cooler an excellent showcase for both character and setting. C, chemistry. I'm not just talking about that hot hallway kiss, but can we stop and talk about that hot hallway kiss? This is where the manic weirdness stops and things get quiet and serious. Please note Nick's relinquishing of his trench moments before. Even though Jess is dating tall drink of water Dr. Sam. And side note, can we also talk about that terrific edit between Dr. Sam asking what was going on and him joining the kiss chorus? She and Nick have undeniable chemistry and not a little bit of codependence. The will they or won't they-ness of their relationship didn't feel old hat because of this chemistry. They're friends, they flirt and tease and kid around, but kissing as part of a game wouldn't feel right for the viewer or the characters. I'm mushy, but I vividly remember my heart swelling when it originally aired when Nick said that he didn't want to kiss Jess like this. Then Nick climbs out of a window and viewers are left to think that the year and a half buildup to the Nick and Jess question will continue on. But then, that end tag. The show knows that gratification can only be delayed for so long, and sticking that kiss at the very end of the episode is perfect. For real, though, Jake Johnson has chemistry with everyone on this show. I think I wanted him to kiss everyone at some point. His characters' respective histories with both Winston and Schmidt bring their relationships to life. These actors play off each other extremely well in a genuine kind of way. It really seems like they're having fun here. For these reasons, I think Cooler is quintessential New Girl. It may not be the funniest episode of the series, but the sum of its parts equals, for me, a classic and fun episode. I hope you had fun watching this too, and will consider giving New Girl a spot in the canon, as any true American should. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you, Corey. Camille, you chose this from our list of submissions. Please start us off. What did you think of the episode and Corey's argument?
I am a New Girl fan, although I think I would say after season 3-4, it really kind of goes off the rails, which is sad to see. But I was delighted to see this candid submission because I do think that as Corey argues so compellingly in her submission, that Cooler is really peak New Girl. I mean, on the strength of that kiss alone, I think that this episode really is canon worthy. I think it's so funny. It's got the classic like boys mess around and then does bring them back into that ridiculously large, beautiful, impossibly beautiful loft to play that classic game of true American. It's so nonsensical. The cold open with the trench coat that just continues, that bit is so weird and it shouldn't work as well as it does. Mm. But the episode really takes that full circle. We see him getting the coat and then we see him returning the coat at the end. And it's like, Miller, why do you think that that coat looks good? There's no answer. And it's just a delight to see. I think that this is also my favorite kind of cast formulation. I was never a big coach fan. And so I think that the setup really works. My only ding against this episode, I would say, is it could use a little bit more Cece. Not in terms of like, I think it works as an episode fine without her, but in terms of being quintessential New Girl, Cece does feel like an element that is missing a little bit. But that will they, won't they energy, that crackling chemistry between Jess and Nick, it's really hard to argue with. I thought that this was a very, very compelling argument.
I'll go next. For me, the absolute joy of this episode is the chunk right at the start where Nick is so enamored of this woman's coat that he found under his doorstep. And let me just play basically the whole cold open because it is really great. The performance is just like spot on. It seems effortless.
Yeah. Look how handsome I look.
That is a woman's coat.
This coat has clean lines and pockets that don't quit.
And it has room for your hips.
And when I wear it, I feel hot to try.
You're wearing a dress.
Yeah, don't say hot to try.
My coat makes me say things like that.
First of all, Nick, it is not your coat.
True, it was delivered to the wrong address. But then tell me, why does it fit like a damn glove?
What is happening to you, man?
I don't know if I could give up looking this damn good.
My coat makes me say things like that is one of the great lines of this episode, for sure. I just love how in love Nick is with this coat. that obviously does not really do him any favors. I love the beginning of this episode more than I love the back half of it, just because of this weird manic energy that Nick brings to the proceedings. And I remember when I watched New Girl for the first time, I really gravitated towards Schmidt just because he's such a cartoonish, accessible sort of, you know, character. He's got the one-liners, craziest backstory and all that kind of stuff. But the more that I revisit New Girl, the more Nick is the one that is absolutely the top of the cast of characters. Right after that scene, there's a scene where all the guys are in a washroom sort of, you know, figuring out what they're going to do to get their mojo back. And there's like this dance dummy moment. And it's just like, even though it is very sitcom-y and written, it also feels like it exists naturally within the confines of this universe. Like all that sort of silliness happens all the time. And the characters really sell it like this is their everyday tone in a way that makes it feel like a lived-in, heightened universe, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. That feels normal.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. My knocks against this episode is I feel like Jess alone scenes are not adorkable like this episode wants to make you feel like it is. I felt those ones kind of dragged on. Although about two-thirds into the episode, there is just a throwaway line about this sort of serial killer-esque character in the greater L.A. area called the Calabasas
Scratcher.
The Calabasas Scratcher, which so I good. Want to believe was the result of about 45 minutes of the writer's table going around and mm-hmm. around, like, you know, like, oh, the, you know, the Eagle Rock Mauler. No.
Yeah.
Like, they just kept on going around and around until they settled on the Calabasas Scratcher, which is like, everybody's like, oh, yeah, we're not going to do better than Calabasas Scratcher. Maybe
And the follow-up, is that a thing? I don't watch local news. It's like, perfectly done. Perfect.
Yeah. I know, like, there's a lot of fandom stuff that were bothered by Nick and Jess, like, sort of that opening that up in the first place. They felt like that was against sort of the roommate-y vibe the show first brought into it, and then sort of they backtracked on that.
It's I'm not clear saying from the pilot they are endgame. I'll just say
absolutely.
That.
I'm saying I disagree with the fandom elements that say that should never have happened. Mm-hmm. I have no problem with it. So even though, like, will they, won't they story arcs, I never care. I never cared in Friends. I never cared really in New Girl. But I wanted to say I never cared one way or the other. It wasn't a detriment. Mm-hmm. But I will say the Nick's crazy smile going into the Iron Curtain kiss was like really worth having that story element mm-hmm. in there for me. So I really gravitate towards the manic energy of Nick in this episode, and has a lot of moments too. And if you're into the, you know, the romantic elements of New Girl, this episode absolutely has that as well. And if you're not, I don't think it takes away. That's my point.
Great. Mm. Great argument.
Also really enjoyed Smash Melon Nick at the end, just as a little coda. It was great.
Sarah.
Oh, this is my first episode of New Girl. The coat thing won me over immediately. I was impressed by, you sort of go in, like, the word adorkable was not going to be bunt nip. Like, none of that is designed to appeal to me. And her, like, manic pixie codependent thing should not, should be more annoying than it is. But Deschanel has an appeal that is, it sort of takes the saccharine out of it a little bit. And they definitely do have chemistry. And she is committed to, like, this drinking game is like, when you, like, any drinking game is, like, ridiculous. And they're always so Byzantine. And the whole point is for you to get fucked up. And I thought that that was extremely well observed. And just, like, all the random yelling. And there was, like, just enough slurring at just the right times. Like, I don't know how I, like, started styling myself an expert on who is good at doing drunk on shows, but this show is good at it. And the, like, it was just such a bizarre and real way of, like, these people drinking together and just, like, jumping around in their loft and being weird. And that chemistry, like, that scene, you're sort of like, when is this going to tip over into, like, sort of like canned, oh, like, territory? And it stays up on this tightrope really amazingly. Mm-hmm. It's quite impressive the way it's paced. And it's like, you can't do that with your face. Like, this is, I mean, this is how these scenes are like in life. And Dave made an excellent point. Like, I think that's a very, it's like sitcom stylized, but also very organic to the universe that it's in. And they do definitely have believable chemistry, and it's not like it's not played, it's not overplayed. They play it like straight, sort of, in that moment. Let us not neglect the chemistry either between one of the picked up ladies, and then she's like, perchance, really? And just like trying to walk him through like this, you know, and what are you going to do about it? And then they're just like under a table with a bottle of SoCo, like, you can do this. And I was like, I would not mind watching like a, you know, callback episode to this. But more to the point, I wanted to like keep watching the show, which is the, you know, Bunsy criterion for this a lot of the time. So yeah, excellent presentation. Once I realized that this very sort of like new girl moment was coming in this episode, I was like, oh, I see what we're doing here. But Dave is also right that even if you don't really care about this, like, you know, ship stuff intra show, this is a very enjoyable 21 minutes of TV. I laughed. That's it.
All right, I'll close it up. I watched New Girl to the bitter end, and to Camille's point, it was bitter.
Emphasis on bitter.
It should have wrapped up sooner than it did, but it still had it had laughs the whole way through, I would say. A couple of notes about the presentation. Jess is the worst character on New Girl. This is something we don't talk about enough. And Dave mentioned that the scenes of her, like her montage of boredom is bad. The only part of it that I enjoyed was when we see her and she thinks someone's trying to get into the apartment and she's like barricaded herself behind a bunch of pillows that 100% just looks like the homewares corner of Anthropology, like every single one of them.
Absolutely.
Straight off the show floor. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, Corey mentioned that Winston is one of the more malleable characters, which is true. But as the show went on, and it wasn't this bad at this point, but because they knew Lamorne Morris could just sell whatever they gave him, Winston turns into just like a bucket of ticks. Like every episode, his storyline is just, what weird thing is Winston's affectation now? You know, what are we supposed to think was always a characteristic of his that's never come up on the show before, and now it's like center stage, which is a problem with this character. But not a problem in this episode. I just felt like I should get that on the record since we've never talked about New Girl for the canon before. It's because this episode is great for all the reasons that have already been said. Great lines from Schmidt. I can't believe you got us kicked out of a discotheque.
Discotheque. Thank you for mentioning that.
Great lines from Nick. You never listen during pipe talk. And like the idea of just Clinton Rules True American being the sexy new twist on True American is like perfect. Mm-hmm. And like Dave already brought it up, Nick going in for the kiss with a creepy smile and his eyes wide open and stuff.
So funny.
Him on the ledge, like trying to escape from having to
that kiss. That I LOL'd. That was great.
And then the kiss, like the payoff is totally worth it. So I think this episode is perfectly paced and timed. It was a problem that they had to wedge Jess into it at the beginning where it's like, we could have just watched the guys at the club and had them come back. Who cares? And Camille is right. This is the only thing that makes it not 100% quintessential New Girl is that there's minimal CC content. But that aside, wonderful episode. The kiss is a heart stopper. And I love this one. So great job.
Yeah. All right. Let's make this official. Camille, canon worthy or not?
Absolutely canon worthy.
I agree. Sarah?
Yep, I agree. Canon.
And Tara?
Same.
All right, that means New Girl Season 2, Episode 15, Cooler. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for the winner and the loser of the week. Sarah has this week's winner.
I do, and it is twofold. Law and Order Organized Crime gets Ellen Burstyn to reprise her Emmy-winning SVU role as Stabler's mother, And fans of butt cheeks, as Chris Maloney claims in Men's Health that he can catch flies in his butt cheeks like a Venus flytrap. I am not convinced that this is a bit. I think he may be able to do it, but this is also someone who knows his audience. And someone tweeted at me his like pink and like neon pink and green outfit with the necklace. And I'm like, I'm going to need the whole outfit, especially since it will then be on the floor and not on him. Maloney is great. Thumbs up.
Remember a few years ago, the Taiwanese news reenactment 3D low fidelity models were all the rage. I kind of want to see that of Chris Maloney catching a fly between his cheeks.
Like on Crimes 360?
Yeah.
Super Maloney.
And Tara, who's a loser?
Oh, boy. Well, Mike Richards is the executive producer of Jeopardy. Jeopardy, as fans will know, has been trying out a bunch of different guest hosts for brief periods of time. And certainly the fandom is always very opinionated about who was good and who sucked ass, Dr. Oz. Mm-hmm. But we found out last week that all of this was just, wasting everyone's time because Mike Richards always intended to make himself the show's permanent host. Fans got pissed because they didn't think he was great. I mean, the fact that this was announced right after LeVar Burton's time guest hosting did not help because everyone loved him, and rightly so. Yeah. But then, on top of that, even it was like he got fully milkshake ducked because it came out that he had a history of harassment and discrimination, allegedly, and now has also had to answer for having been named in a lawsuit regarding sexual harassment at The Price is Right many years ago, being like, that's not who I am, where it's like, aren't you, though? So, Mike
Seems
Richards.
Seems like it is, maybe.
Yeah. Not great. Not great. No. Just hire LeVar Burton. It's what everyone wants.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah.
Speaking about not great, do you know what time it is?
Jeopardy time?
No, it's what everyone wants. Come on. What is game time?
Super game time!
Yes, it is the fifth game time of this super season. Season scores are Tara with 2, Sarah with 2, value guests still looking to get on the board. Today we are playing Alter Egos from longtime game contributor David Ellis Dickerson, who earns himself an extra credit. Topic. He writes, we live in a strange time where almost every actor we see on a normal TV show has a good chance of having had superpowers somewhere else. Mm-hmm. In this game, I will give you the name of a comic book superhero or supervillain and describe what the actor who plays them is doing in a completely different show the actor was in. So, for example, if I said, in his secret identity, Super Grover puts on a bow tie and performs for a comedy variety show run by a frog. You know I was talking about the shows Sesame Street and The Muppet Show, and Super Grover and Fozzie the Bear were both voiced by Frank Oz.
Right.
So the answer will be two shows and the actor in question.
Okay.
So 3 points possible per question. There are no hints because this is one of those lots of information point triangulation games.
Got it. Mm-hmm.
All right. So note, however, unlike the example I just gave, all of the shows in this quiz are live action superhero shows, most of which are from the past 10 years. And we have a new addition to the game time rule set, which is ever growing and ever confusing. It is the Eric Steelmill. He suggested, and we thought it was a good idea, that each week we give value guests one steel meal to use just for that week. You can't bank them, but this week value guests have one bank steel meal, so they have two steel meals that they can use today. So we'll always add one to their total, but that one cannot be banked. Make sense?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
So with that information, Tara, can we get the steel meal situation, please?
Yes. Sarah D. Bunting has 4 steel meals. I have 9 steel meals. Camille has 2 steel meals. So Camille, how this works is, if another player answers wrong, you can leap in before Dave gives the correct answer and you can steal the point by saying steal meal real fast.
All right, let's throw it to Picky to see our order today.
We will start with Sarah.
All right, we're going Sarah, Camille, Tara, 27 questions, 1 gross worth equalizer challenge zone in play today. Are we ready to play Alter Egos?
Yes.
Super yes.
All right, Sarah D. Bunting. The villain Kilgrave moonlights as a wary British police detective solving a boy's murder in Dorset. Name the two shows in question. So we have a supervillain superhero show, mm-hmm. another show, and then name the actor that played both.
Okay, so Kilgrave was Jessica Jones, and he was also, he and his bad ticker won Broadchurch, and that's David Tennant.
Yes, 3 points. Boom, boom, boom. That's how you do it. Camille, when she's not a powerful super witch, Agatha Harkness is a ridiculously overpaid Washington political consultant hired to help Bobby Newport win a seat on the Pawnee, Indiana City Council.
Okay, so we've got WandaVision, we've got Parks and Rec, and we have the fabulous Katherine Hahn.
That is good for three. Tara?
Yes.
The Kingpin, a.k.a. Wilson Fisk, solves crimes for the NYPD with such brilliance that you wonder why his co-lead bothered to show up.
That is Vincent D'Onofrio and his D'Onofrionics on Daredevil and Law & Order : Criminal Intent.
Yes, everybody with 3 points to start things off. Back to Sarah D. Bunting. Arthur the Moth was also a mustachioed A&R rep at American Century Records in 1973 New York.
Arthur the Moth? Is that The Tick? Okay, I will take that point. And then maybe in 1973 New York, that is the thing called, that it was a show with that guy with the nose.
All this information checks out so far. It was a show with a guy with a nose. Correct.
Yep. It's a super, super show.
It wasn't, actually. That's where you're going.
We talked about it. We didn't like it.
God. I don't know. I can't pull the show, and I can't obviously pull the actor either. So let's try James Franco.
Incorrect. You did get one out of the 3 points, though. The other pieces of information we're looking for. Tara, do you know the other show?
Well, it's Vinyl, but I don't know who the actor is. Who
also the actor played... is Griffin Newman.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
There have been so many Arthurs.
Camille, before Night Sister swallowed her father's nostalgia pills, she was a convert to Islam, Kevin's strict mother, and a social worker who wants to have a baby in three different states and in three different years.
This is giving me nothing. I got nothing.
Absolutely nothing? Yeah, all right. This is nothing. A 3-point steel meal situation if anybody wants to take it.
Nope.
All right.
Nope.
Before Night Sister swallowed her father's nostalgia pills, Watchmen. She was a convert to Islam, Kevin's strict mother, et cetera, et cetera.
American Crime.
Right. That is Regina King.
Oh.
Right.
Tara.
Yes.
Before he destroyed Bruce Wayne's city, the villain Ra's al Ghul worked as the chief medical officer on a space station in the Alpha Quadrant.
I should know who. Okay, I'm going to just say Gotham is one of the shows. Medical officer. I don't know who the actor, so I don't know the other show.
The Alpha Quadrant is the setting for Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Oh.
And that's Dr.
Alexander...
Bashir.
Oh, Siddig.
Siddig. Correct.
Right.
All right, back to Sarah. Before he was known as the Martian Manhunter, he was the CIA's counterterrorism director and may have slept with one of his female operations officers.
I don't know. I have not one clue. Is one of the shows Homeland? Oh, okay.
That's all I had
too. I'm out of things that I know.
All right, one out of the three. And I will say, Dave did design this. He said to me personally that a lot of these questions, you're not even going to get a crack at the three. You got to win them on the ones and twos. And this is certainly one of them. Supergirl is where you'll find Martian Manhunter. Okay. Homeland. And we're talking about David Harwood. David Harwood.
Oh,
that guy.
Yeah.
Harwood or Harewood.
Right.
All right. Back to Camille. Bobby Morse, codenamed Mockingbird, grew up as the hot bad girl in a small Texas football town.
Okay, so Friday Night Lights is one of the shows. Can you give me the first part of the clue again?
Bobby Morse, Bobby with an I. Codename Mockingbird is the first part of that clue.
Yeah, I have no idea who that is, so I'm just gonna... I think that's all I got. I think I'll...
You want to take a crack at an actor from Friday Night Lights?
If it's one of the young ones, I don't know. If it's not Connie Britton, I don't know.
It is not.
I couldn't pull her name either.
Mockingbird is from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Mm. And okay. You were correct on Friday Night Lights. And the actress is CSI...
Recent
party.
Guest star in
yeah,
our
guest star that we just watched last night.
Adrian Palicki.
Yes, that is correct. What does Tara just said? And speaking about Tara, here's your question.
Okay.
Before she became the psychotic criminal Alice, leader of Gotham City's Wonderland gang, she was Elizabeth Tudor of England.
Okay. I don't know the actor's name, but I'm going to say that's Batwoman. And... The Tudors?
Okay. That's Batwoman is correct. Rain.
Oh, Rain. The other show. Right.
That's Rachel Skarsten.
Right. All the sleeveless castle dresses of Rain.
the midriffian Tudor wear.
All right. Sarah D. Bunting.
Yes.
He Who Remains spent the 1950s fighting cultists, monsters, and a whole lot of racists.
I'm going to be annoyed, but I just don't have the first idea of any of these. Sorry.
Hey, Camille.
I know this one.
Well, okay, Steel Mill from Camille.
So it is Jonathan Majors in Loki and Lovecraft Country.
Yes, 3 points, Steel Mill. Nicely done.
Camille pulls ahead.
Lovecraft Country, and then I was like, no, that's too... It's too
and
easy. Now,
and Camille, here's your actual question. Claire Temple, a.k.a. Night Nurse, moonlights as a lawyer in Miami who gets disbarred after dating a murderess with no karate involved this time.
I'm glad I got that steal because no clue. No clue on this one.
Nothing? Anybody know any part of that? Okay, Tara?
I know, but I'm not going to use the steel mail. I think that's Rosario Dawson in Jane the Virgin and all of the various Luke Cage, etc., all the Marvel shows on
Iron Fist is one in particular here, but yes, she's on all of those Defender shows in some capacity.
Defenders, I couldn't remember what they were called.
Or other. All right, Tara.
Yes.
Bat-Manuel used to be a photographer working along Brooke Shields.
Oh no, what's his name? Okay, that's Veronica's Closet. No? Brooke Shields, shit! Suddenly Susan. Okay, the other show is...
Wait, hang on. You've already said two shows, so we just got the actor left here.
Okay. Oh my God, what is his name? His eyelashes are so long. He was in Lost, but that's not the other show. I don't remember his name.
Nestor
Carbonell.
Yes.
Also
the show was Suddenly Susan.
Suddenly Susan.
And that was the Fox version of The Tick. The first one we heard was the Amazon version of The Tick. All right.
Okay.
One question left for each of you before we get into our score break. This is for Sarah. Agent Orange, a ruthless CIA operative who created our violent, revenge-seeking hero by murdering his family, was once the favorite priest of a mobster's wife.
Okay. Oh, fuck. I did a 2 stars, 1 slot on this mofo also.
You sure
all
did.
Right. It's Father Intentula from The Sopranos, who was played by Paul Schulze?
Yes!
Whew! And,
Violence, revenge, murder family.
CIA.
CIA.
The CIA. Oh, Super Batman. I don't know. Gotham again?
Incorrect. Know. That is The Punisher. The Punisher.
Oh.
All right.
Well, I'm not going to punish myself for not knowing that because Father Intitula.
You got 2 points.
You did.
That was a good pull. All right, Camille. When she's not a superpowered police detective teaming up with other NYC heroes, Jessica Jones is a terrible roommate who's friends with James Vanderbeek.
So one of the shows has to be Dawson's Creek? Then I have no idea.
It's so nothing, bad at nothing this. On the first part? Jessica Jones? Teaming up? I may have read the answer about a minute and a half ago. Said the answer, rather.
Luke Cage?
Good guess. You're in the right area.
Yeah.
We're looking for The Defenders, which is where Jessica Jones teams up with all the other Hell's Kitchen superheroes. Very localized team right there in Hell's Kitchen. The other show where Kristen Ritter teams up with James Vanderbeek is Don't Trust the Bee in Apartment 23.
Totally misunderstood that clue.
Tara,
damn it.
Take us into our score break.
Yes.
In a slight switch, Howard Stark, the father of Iron Man, whose superpower is having wealth and using it, has another life where he's a small-town pastor with a vampire sidekick who discovers he has the power to make people do what he says.
Okay, that's Preacher and Agent Carter. And the actor's name from Mamma Mia is Dominic Cooper?
Yes. Three points. Boom, boom, boom.
That was
and
very
that'll take us into our score break. So let's get them scores set.
It is such a close game. I have 9 points. Camille and Sarah are tied with 7 points each.
Oh, how exciting.
Team up!
All right, we are now in the Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zone. You have your choice. I have three sets of Trivial Pursuit questions right here. You can collectively decide whether you want the original TV box question from the 80s, the 90s edition pop culture box, or the one called Pop Culture 2, which is a little, the newest, but is sort of a mélange of eras.
Yeah, if we're deferring to me, let's go with that Pop Culture 2. Please.
Okay, Pop Culture 2.
Love it.
Come on!
Six
all right,
TV.
Before you start, do you each get 3 points? If
yes.
They, all right.
Correct.
Good luck, guys.
And
you'll
then if we run
the
card, the we each get
you...
six, right?
That's correct.
Correct.
Yes, yeah. Okay.
All right. Question number one. What MTV game show helped launch Dennis Leary, Colin Quinn, and Adam Sandler's TV careers?
I know this one. If I may, Camille, it's Remote Control.
Right? It is Remote Control. Correct. That's answer number one. Who provided the cartoon voice of Johnny Quest before landing the role of Otter in Animal House?
Played Otter. Fuck.
Who played Otter in Animal House, also voiced in Johnny Quest?
And also, I think, dated Irina on The Sopranos. Why can't I pull this name?
That is Tim Matheson.
It! All right. Well, I had the wrong guy anyway, so...
You can't sweep it, but you can still get two more for your 3 points each. What South Park character was so moved by the Passion of the Christ that he started praying to his Mel Gibson poster? Which South Park character did that?
I've watched like 3 episodes of the show, so I defer.
Camille, South Park superfan Camille Washington. What do you think? What character for South Park?
Right?
Cartman, you said?
Yeah.
Yes, you are correct.
Yay!
It's always Cartman.
Better together.
What series' diehard fans make pilgrimages to North Bend, Washington to view the Great Northern Hotel, The Mill, and Ronette's Bridge?
I assume this is Twin Peaks, but I'll hear
it. Is Twin Peaks. I'll just give it to you right there.
Boom. Yay, we did it.
You both have added 3 points to your total, so update those scores, please, Tara.
It's still close, but it's no longer in my favor. Now I have 9 points, and Camille and Sarah tied with 10 each.
All right, here we go. Everybody's got 4 questions left, so 12 possible points for each of you to add to your total. We go back to Sarah D. Bunting. The non-saxophone playing monster witch sorceress Lucy Devlin, a.k.a. the Amazing Celine, was on a reality show where 6 young roommates shared a flat in Notting Hill Gate.
Is the second show Real World London? Because if it isn't...
Oh, it is? And okay. So the question's also wrong because there's 7 roommates. Unless one of them died that season.
I think someone went home. Does it? Oh. Joe Reed can correct us next week.
Okay.
All right. So that's, I hope, Jacinda Barrett.
All right. What's the other show with the non-saxophone playing monster witch sorceress?
Benson.
No. If it's no Super saxophone Benson? Clue, it's got to be Nightman.
I can't believe you don't have a Nightman drop.
I do have it, but it's not.
I thought about answering Nightman, but I was like, no. Oh, no! This is worse than jazz.
All right.
Fantastic.
Camille. Yeah. Jax Ur, and that's J-A-X hyphen U-R. Jax Ur, also known as Sela Son, went from fighting Sig El to owning a soccer team in Richmond that she wants to destroy. A lot of nonsense names there.
Okay.
She went from fighting Sig El to owning a soccer team in Richmond that she wants to destroy.
Ted Lasso. Oh my God, what is her name? I know her name.
I mean, you should know her name since she's Christina's wife.
I know. She's going to kill me. Hannah. Obana. I don't have the last name.
You're right on Hannah, though. Any idea on the other show?
I have no clue on the other show.
It's a tough one. Yeah. All those garbage names are Superman names. That's from the show Krypton.
Oh, right.
Ted Lasso was correct. And we're talking about Hannah Waddingham.
Right.
Not in a million
years. Sorry, CT. I failed you. Oh, my God.
Yes.
Killer Frost was once the 16-year-old daughter of an extremely aggressive and amoral public DA played by everybody's favorite actor, James Wood.
Oh, God. Well, I'm going to guess that the show is Shark. Not Shark Tank and not Super Shark. But I don't remember who played his daughter on that show, and I don't know what the other show is.
The other show is Flash.
Oh.
And we're talking about Danielle Pennebaker.
Oh, sure.
This is question 19. We're back to Sarah. Misty Knight, a cop with a robotic arm, is actually a cybernetically enhanced bounty hunter in the post-humanist future who has been hired to bring Takashi Kovach when he is being played by Anthony Mackie.
And now the only person I can picture is Missy Pyle, and that's really not helping. So, Law and Order Cyber?
Century City? No.
Space Lawyers! I don't know this one at all.
Anybody know any part of that?
Well, she's from Luke Cage, but I don't remember what the actor's name is or the other show.
Nicole Missick from Luke Cage and Altered Carbon when the lead pops in and out of definitely. Joel Kinnaman was in that, and Anthony Mackie as well, playing different versions of the same character. I believe, don't quote me on that, and I gave up after a couple episodes.
Super Grayish.
Camille. Professor Charles Xavier stopped watching over his schizophrenic mutant son and wound up as the Beggar King across Westeros, managing ultimately to force his sister to marry a barbarian warrior.
Oh, okay. So we know one of the shows is Game of Thrones. I can picture that horrible wig.
He is always so weaselly.
And what's the first? What's
Professor
the show?
Charles Xavier stopped watching over his schizophrenic mutant son.
So some sort of X-Men, surely. Don't know this actor's name, and I don't know which show it is.
All right, you got 1 point, though. You were correct on Game of Thrones. The actor is Harry Lloyd, and the other show is Legion. Legion. Tara.
Okay. Yeah.
The almost immortal utopian leader of the Union of Justice was also secretly an ex-Marine working at Montecito Casino in Nevada. Blech.
Okay, well, the one show is Las Vegas. I don't know any. I'll just say James Caan, even though it's wrong, because I don't know anyone else on that show. And I don't know the other show.
The other show is Jupiter's Legacy.
Of course.
And the actor in common is Josh Duhamel.
Oh. Oh, right.
Sarah, the creator and operator of the giant robot Stripe, Special Tactics Robotic Integrated Power Enhancer, is also the ex-husband of a corporate buyer who causes chaos with her new self-help obsession.
I don't know. So to keep everyone entertained, let's say that the first show is Knight Rider 2000.
What if it was?
What if it was?
It should be. That's a very Knight Rider-y acronym there. What is it in fact?
The answers we were looking for, pause, no steam mills. The answers looking for are Stargirl, that's for the robot, Enlightened, that's the corporate buyer.
Oh, right.
Self help obsession.
Right.
And the common actor is Luke Wilson in both.
Oh, wow. Okay.
All right. Back to Camille. The comic book angel Manny, who looks over his chain smoking exorcist friend, has also been seen on the island trying to find his son, Walt.
I'm not going to know the second show, but we know Lost. And
father to Walt.
Yeah, I'm seeing him screaming over and over again, fighting
or on
with
Twitter,
Jim.
Yelling at Judd Apatow.
Yeah, I don't have it. I don't have the name.
I'm gonna steal meal just for the actor, which is Harold Perrineau.
Good for one. Ugh. You want to take a guess on the steal for the second show? Comic book angel Manny looks over his chain smoking exorcist friend. Superhero or supervillain there?
Lucifer?
Good guess.
Incorrect. That's the show Constantine, John Constantine.
Constantine, fuck. Okay, well.
Tara.
Yes.
Under those bandages, Negative Man is a really handsome con artist who helps the FBI nab rich people.
He's not really under those bandages. That's just some guy. That's Matt Bomer in Doom Patrol. And White Collar.
His voice is under those bandages.
Sure,
his voice sure surely. Is.
Yes. And then for the two times a year, he has to come into the set and they
for
actually show.
Or yeah. Whatever.
He has a lot of kids. He doesn't have a lot of time.
Last question for everybody, so let's get these scores quickly.
Oh, God!
It could scarcely be closer. Sarah and Camille are tied with 13. I have 14.
Okay. Everybody has 3 points to get, so it's anybody's game mathematically. Here we go. Sarah D. Bunting.
Yes.
The super, again, super was in the original question. The super smart hero Brainiac used to be a British vampire who stupidly fell in love with a slayer.
Okay, I believe that this is Mr. James Marsters, who was on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and Angel, if we feel like giving me an extra point for some reason. I don't know why you would do that. Okay, the super smart...
Brainiac.
Super smart Brainiac.
Super smart hero Brainiac, which I guess is something in the show because I would think he is a villain, but you know, who knows how they're writing him there.
I don't know. So I'm going to guess Pinky and the Brain. Yak.
Incorrect. The Brainiac is usually a foe for Superman, and that is Smallville.
Oh.
Smallville.
Oh, right. Duh.
Camille, your last question. The now heroic flame gun wielding Heatwave was once a falsely imprisoned convict framed for the murder of the vice president's brother. Fortunately, he himself had a brother with a plan.
Okay, I have no idea, but I'm just going to throw some shows out there. The Boys?
Good guess.
Okay.
Yeah, I can see that guess. Good one.
And then, I don't know.
Falsely imprisoned convict. Brother with a plan.
Sit. What is that show? Prison Break?
Yeah!
All right, any idea on the actor?
No idea.
But she's happy with that 1 point. That was a great celebration.
I steel mail the other two?
You sure can.
Legends of Tomorrow, and it's Dominic Purcell.
Yes, two points steel mail. Nicely done. All right, Tara.
Yes.
This is your last question.
Okay.
The Star City vigilante, known as Black Canary, is also the blonde junior publicist for WPK Public Relations in a very specific and melodramatic Los Angeles neighborhood.
Okay, that's Katie Cassidy from the Melrose Place sequel. Black Canary. Is that Arrow?
Yes, 3 points at the last question. That is regulation, so let's hear the scores.
Everyone finished very strong. Camille had 14, and now Sarah and I are tied.
Oh, shit.
With 17!
I have no idea how to do this because it's a three-part question.
Well, you could always decide on Dave points because one of us has way more than the other.
No.
This could finally be what Dave points are for.
All right, since there's three pieces of information, we'll do this slightly differently. You have to say buzz or go buzz, and then you'll be the first person to give the answer. I need all three pieces of information to win. Are you ready, Tara?
Yes.
Are you ready, Sarah?
Super yes.
The surprise super villainess known as the Power Broker was once a juvenile delinquent with a tragic past who vowed to destroy everyone she knew in the Hamptons.
What if I only have two of three parts?
They're fucked.
I'm fucked then. Yeah, same. And we have the same two.
We do.
All right, just give me the two.
Okay.
Tara, give me the two.
Sure. It's Emily Van Camp from Sarah.
Revenge.
Okay. The surprise villainess known as the Power Broker is the other part of the clue.
Oh, God.
We're still going. Chime in when you need it.
Falcon and the Winter Peanut Butter Falcon Soldier Snowman. Falcon the Winter Snowman.
You are correct. All right, we're going to give that one to Tara after a belabored tie-breaking round. My apologies.
Well fought.
The format wasn't really super great for the tiebreaker, but we got through it.
We did.
Tara.
And I still didn't have to watch Falcon and the Winter.
Neither did I.
In many ways, you're both winners for that. Well, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We learned a few things from Mr. Corbin before going around the dial with stops at First Wives Club, F-Boy Island, Real Housewives of Potomac, Super Heists, Money Court, and UFO. Courtney and Craig asked us which TV characters absolutely vape, and another Corey not a boy was not a cannon cooler when it came to New Girl's submission. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time from David. Next up, co-host couples on Extra Extra Hot Great, and on the next Super EHD Prime Heels with Joe Reed. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Irano,
F-boy, F-bye,
Sarah D. Bunting.
You can't do that with your face.
And Camille Washington.
Oh, goodness.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
I like this feeling, you guys. I'm liking the vibe that we got going here. There's definitely going to be some sex having tonight.
Oh, yeah. Damn it, there needs to be.